In chapter 5 of Edersheim, he gives a history and a background of Alexandria and the Jewish communities in the capital of Egypt, in Alexandria and in the capital of the Roman Empire, Rome, which then were the central things for Jewish Hellenism. It's also important for us to understand that the great community that was there in Alexandria, and they had a great synagogue cathedral, and it says of this great synagogue cathedral that they had an eldership of a Sanhedrin of Alexandria on the model of the great Sanhedrin in Jerusalem. And it is a strange and almost inexplicable fact that the Egyptian Jews had actually built a schismatic temple. So there was a temple in Egypt that the Jews had their own priesthood that they officiated at. And it was during the terrible Syrian persecutions in Palestine that Onias, the son of the murdered high priest Onias III, had sought safety in Egypt. And Ptolemy Philometor not only received him kindly, but gave him a disused heathen temple in the town of Leontopolis for a Jewish sanctuary. Here a newer Aaronic priesthood ministered, their support being derived from the revenues of the district around. The new temple, however, resembled not that of Jerusalem, either in the outward appearance nor in its interior fittings. At first, the Egyptian Jews were very proud of their new sanctuary and professed to see it in the fulfillment of the prediction, that is, that five cities in the land of Egypt would speak the language of Cana, and of which one was called Ahasuerus, which was in the Septuagint, which then was called the City of Righteousness. This temple continued from about 160 B.C. to shortly after the destruction of Jerusalem, and this has a great bearing on what happened to the New Testament church, because here was a renegade priesthood. Here was one where they declared that they were fulfilling Scripture, and also of the Scripture in Isaiah, which says, "For out of Egypt shall my son come." And so this Onias wanted to fulfill that. Now, when we understand that this occurred just right after the desecration of the temple in Jerusalem, that it really is profound. Now, they didn't offer animal sacrifices there, but they offered incense and wine and meal offerings on a daily basis, and we will see that this actually was a foundational beginning of what is known in the Catholic Church today as the Eucharist, or the substitute for what we call the Passover. This temple continued from about 160 B.C. shortly after the destruction of Jerusalem. It could scarcely be called a rival to that on Mount Moriah, since the Egyptian Jews also owned that of Jerusalem as their central sanctuary, to which they made pilgrimages and brought their contributions, while the priest at Leontopolis, before marrying, always consulted the official archives in Jerusalem to ascertain the purity of descent of their intended wives. The Palestinians designated it contemptuously as the house of Onias, and declared the priesthood of Leontopolis incapable of serving in Jerusalem, although on a par with those who were disqualified, that is, the priests who were disqualified with some bodily defect. Offerings brought in Leontopolis were considered null, unless in the case of vows to which the name of this temple had been expressly attached. This qualified condemnation seems, however, strangely mild, except on the supposition that the statements we have, quote, only date from the time when both temples had long passed away. Nor were such feelings unreasonable. The Egyptian Jews had spread on all sides, southward to Abyssinia and Ethiopia, and westward to and beyond the province of Cyrene. And so what he's showing here is the whole tremendous effect of what this temple in Egypt had on Hellenizing Judaism, and also on the setup of the synagogues, the way that the high priest at Leontopolis was regarded by the Jews in Egypt. Now also they had some important things happening with the temple at Jerusalem, because much of the money that came to support it came from Egypt. So they couldn't renounce and denounce the temple at Leontopolis completely, because they were getting money for the temple at Jerusalem from the Jews in Egypt. The temple at Jerusalem bore evidence of the wealth and munificence of this Jewish millionaire who was, what was his name here? Antonia. The gold and silver with which the nine massive gates were covered, which led into the temple, were the gift of the great Alexandrian banker. And so here we have set up a Judaism which was based on Greek philosophy combined with the scriptures of the Old Testament, with the temple in Leontopolis, with its own Jewish priesthood, which did not necessarily follow the things that they did at the temple in Jerusalem. So this really quite an event, and this is something that Eastern Judaism does not like to tell us, and of which all of these books on Gnosticism are based upon. What happened there, and how was it that we came to have the Catholic Church as we have it today? Now we need to cover a couple of other things concerning the Jewish community in another very important city called Antioch. And as you know, Antioch then was the place where we had the greatest number of Gentile converts, and as a matter of fact, that is the first place where it is noted that Christians were called Christians. Now, just to project a little ahead of some of the things that we're going to cover down the road, while we're covering Edersheim, want to get into what he says here concerning Antioch and concerning the Jews at Antioch and some of the things which may tie in to the problems that the Christian church had from the circumcision party within the church and those who supposedly came down from Jerusalem. And we find the confrontation between Paul and Peter in Galatians, the second chapter. But I want to cover just a little bit here concerning Antioch, which was the capital of Assyria. The connection between Jerusalem and Antioch was very close. All that occurred in that city was eagerly watched in the Jewish capital. The spread of Christianity there must have excited deep concern. Careful as the Talmud is to avoid unwelcome information, which might have led to further mischief, that's a nice way of saying, of showing the problems that Christianity was causing Judaism, he says, continuing here, we know that three of the principal rabbis went to Antioch on a mission, and we can scarcely doubt for the purpose of arresting the progress of Christianity. So we may find a connection here between rabbinism and trying to bring circumcision and ritualism upon the church through that form of Pharisaism. And this probably very deeply affected Peter, because that was no small little problem that was involved in Galatians, the second chapter, as we will see when we come to it at the appropriate time. But I wanted to mention that here because that follows right along in some of the things I'm reading out of Edersheim. Now, I realize that some of this is pretty heavy reading, and it's written in a very awkward form, so some of the reading is very difficult even for me. So he says, continuing here, again, we find at a later period a record of religious controversy in Antioch between rabbis and Christians. Yet the Jews of Antioch were strictly Hellenistic. And on one occasion, a great rabbi was unable to find among them a copy of even the book of Esther in Hebrew. So this shows the things that they had. There was also a large synagogue there. And so we have some really difficult problems to deal with in understanding what was happening in the early New Testament church. What was happening within Judaism? Why was it that Jesus stayed mostly in Galilee and did not come to Jerusalem but to visit it? Why do we have all of this influence of the Greeks, the Greek Old Testament, the whole thing concerning the New Testament church? Why was there this great controversy? Why is it that Pharisaism today, basically formed out of the remnants of Eastern Judaism, do not tell us very much or if little, if anything, concerning Western Judaism and all the effects that it had? Well, these are some of the questions that we are going to cover. Now, as we have seen previously, when Ezra came back out of Babylon and canonized the scriptures, set up the synagogal system, and set up the reading of the scriptures in the synagogue, and with the various instructions for that, which later became to be known as tradition. Those were essentially good rules on how to keep people involved in the scriptures. However, because of the apostatizing Jews and because of getting more and more into heathenism, especially getting more and more into Grecianism, as it were, and actually beginning to lose track of their Jewishness, even Greek-speaking Jews had to take a firm stand against all of the idolatry, against all of the Grecianism, against all the heathenism that came about. So now we have the beginning of all of the traditions then which separated the Jews from the Gentiles. And so here's part of what Edersheim says about this. This abhorrence of all connected with idolatry and the contempt entertained for all that was non-Jewish will in great measure explain the code of legislation intended to keep the Jew and Gentile apart, which I've got a book called The Code of Jewish Law by Gans, Reed, and Golden. Maybe we'll get into some of that after we get done with this. I don't think we'll make it on this particular cassette, though. To begin with, every Gentile child, as soon as born, was to be regarded as unclean. And this is the basis for a lot of the clean and unclean laws, which have nothing to do with clean and unclean meats or health or sanitary things, as concerned in the Old Testament, and this had a great bearing on trying to bring the New Testament church out of Judaism. And notice this attitude, that as soon as it was born, it was regarded as unclean. Also, those who actually worshipped mountains, hills, bushes, etc., in short, gross idolaters, should be cut down with the sword. Now, we are going to see the tremendous and gross discrimination that the Jews had against anyone and anything which was not accepted by them and their most stringent rules and regulations. This is something to say that they should be cut down with a sword. However, with the Jews living in the area, it was impossible to exterminate heathenism. Rabbinic legislation kept certain definite objects in view, which may be summarized thus. To prevent Jews from being inadvertently led into idolatry, to avoid all participation in idolatry, not to do anything which would aid the heathen in their worship, and beyond all this, not to give pleasure, nor even help to the heathens. The latter involved a most dangerous principle, capable of almost indefinite application by fanaticism. Even the Mishnah goes so far as to forbid aid to a mother in the hour of her need, or nourishment to her babe, in order to bring up a child for idolatry. But this is not all. Heathens were indeed not to be precipitated into danger, but yet not to be delivered from it. Indeed, an isolated teacher ventures even upon this statement. The best among the Gentiles, kill. The best among serpents, crush its head. Still more terrible was the fanaticism which directed that heretics, traitors, and those who had left the Jewish faith should be thrown into actual danger, and if they were in it, all means for their escape removed. No interference of any kind was to be had with such, not even to invoke their medical aid in the case of danger to life, since it was deemed that he who had to do with heretics was in imminent peril of becoming one himself, and that if a heretic returned to the true faith, he should die at once, partly, probably, to expiate his guilt, and partly from the fear of relapse. Terrible as all of this sounds, it was probably not worse than the fanaticism displayed in what are called more enlightened times. Impartial history must chronicle it, however painful, to show the circumstances in which teaching so far different was propounded by Christ. In other words, what Jesus taught was so different, it was diametrically opposite of what Judaism was preaching. Now, I just want to bring out something here very clearly. That notice the attitude that was taken here toward all people. And the New Testament church had to bring the church out of this kind of thinking. Remember when Peter told Cornelius, "You know that it is an unlawful thing for a man who is a Jew to come unto one who is a Gentile, or to have company with him, or to eat with him." Yes, these things did affect the church. And this is what the church came out of. So for people to say that Christianity was built on Judaism is an absolute and gross total error. It came out of Judaism. It came out of this behavior. It came out of these circumstances. Now let's continue on with what Edersheim says here to finish this chapter, which talks about many of the different things that the Jews did to avoid, to segregate, to discriminate, to alienate, to completely separate themselves from even the presence, the look, the sound, the smell, the company of Jews with Gentiles. In truth, the bitter hatred which the Jew bore to the Gentile can only be explained from the estimate entertained of his character, that is, of the what the Jew thought of the Gentile. The most vile and even unnatural crimes were imputed to them. It was not safe to leave cattle in their charge, to allow their women to nurse infants, or their physicians to attend the sick, nor to walk in their company without taking precautions against sudden and unprovoked attacks. They should, so far as possible, be altogether avoided, except in cases of necessity or for the sake of common business. They and theirs were defiled, their houses unclean, as containing idols or things dedicated to them. Their feasts, their joyous occasions, their very contact was polluted by idolatry. And there was no security if a heathen were left alone in a room, that he might not in wantonness or by carelessness defile the wine or the meat on the table, or the oil and the wheat in the store. Under such circumstances, therefore, everything must be regarded as having been rendered unclean. 3 days before a heathen festival, according to some, also 3 days after, every business transaction with them was prohibited, for fear of giving either help or pleasure. Jews were to avoid passing through a city where there was an idolatrous feast. Yea, they were not even to sit down within the shadow of a tree dedicated to idol worship. Its wood was polluted, and if flour was used in baking, the bread was unclean. If the shuttle had been made of it, not only was all the cloth woven on it forbidden, but if such had been inadvertently mixed with other pieces of cloth or a garment made from it placed on other garments, the whole became unclean. Jewish workmen were not to assist in building basilicas or stadia or places where judicial sentences were pronounced by the heathen. Of course, it was not lawful to let houses or to lease out houses or fields or to sell cattle to them. milk drawn by a heathen, if a Jew had not been present to watch it, bread and oil prepared by them were unlawful. The wine was wholly interdicted. The mere touch of a heathen polluted a whole cask of wine. Nay, even to put one's nose into the heathen wine was strictly prohibited. Painful as all of these details are, they might be multiplied, and yet the bigotry of these rabbis was perhaps not worse than that of the other sectaries, that is, other sectarian groups. It was a painful logical necessity of their system against which their heart, no doubt, often rebelled, and it must be truthfully added, it was in measure accounted for by the terrible history of Israel, i.e., the Jews. And when we get into some of the code of Jewish law, you're going to see that what he brought out here is really very mild. And if you are able to get a book of the code of Jewish law, let me just tell you right now that it is printed by the Hebrew Publishing Company, Post Office Box 157, Rockaway, New York, 11693. Now, I just might mention that if you get the whole code of Jewish law, there are thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of laws, and they're mind-boggling. I'll read a few of them, maybe not on this cassette, but one in a future cassette when we get in more particularly into what would a Church of the Pharisees be like. Now, during the time leading up to Antiochus Epiphanes, which Edersheim calls his severe domestic troubles, which was the beginning with the persecution under the Seleucidae, which marked the mortal struggle between Judaism and Grecianism, the great assembly had disappeared from the scene. The Sopharim had ceased to be a party in power, and they had become elders whose task was purely ecclesiastical, the preservation of their religion, such as dogmatic labors of their predecessors had made it. Yet another period opened with the advent of the Maccabees. These had been raised into power by the enthusiasm of the Chassidim, or the pious ones, who formed the nationalist party in the land and who had gathered around the liberators of their faith and country. But the later bearing of the Maccabees had alienated the nationalists. Henceforth, they sink out of view, or rather, the extreme section of them emerge in the extreme section of the Pharisees, till fresh national calamities awakened a new nationalistic party. Instead of the Chassidim, we now have two religious parties within the synagogue, the Pharisees and the Sadducees. Now, we'll have quite a bit more to say about the Pharisees and the Sadducees, because the Pharisees conformed those who wanted to be priest-like, but were not priests. And the Sadducees were, in fact, of the high priest family. However, many of the high priests were very Hellenized. So you've got this almost incongruous setup that a lot of the high priests were Hellenized. In spite of that, they claimed that as high priest or as priest, the only thing they would recognize would be just the scriptures. The Pharisees, on the other hand, wanted to try and take over and dictate all of the powers and all of the rituals that the Sadducees would do because they considered the Sadducees unfit. Well, this struggle went back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, and finally, in about 5 or 6 B.C., most of the Pharisees were killed. And so when we come down to the time of Jesus Christ, the Pharisees had gained some of their power back, but as we will see when we read in Jeremiah, that they didn't have the power which they now ascribe to themselves, and in particularly through Josephus, claim to have had over the Sadducees, was really not true and did not exist. This has a great bearing on how we count Pentecost when we get down to that particular section of it. Von Edersheim gives a little history leading up to what is called the Sanhedrin. And this he says of the Sanhedrin. The power of the Sanhedrin would, of course, vary with political circumstances, being at times almost absolute, as in the reign of the Pharisaic devotee, Queen Alexandria, while at other times it was shorn of all but its ecclesiastical authority. Ben Edersheim shows clearly that the Sanhedrin was in full force at the time of Jesus. Now continuing with Edersheim, he says, after this brief outline of the origin and development of an institution which exerted such decisive influence on the future of Israel, it must seem necessarily similar to trace the growth of the traditions of the elders so as to understand what, alas, so effectively opposed the new doctrine of the kingdom. The first place must be here assigned to those legal determinations which traditionalism declared absolutely binding on all, not only of equal, but of greater obligation than the Scripture itself. And this not illogically, since tradition was equally of divine origin with Holy Scripture and authoritatively explained its meaning and supplemented it. So there we have how they looked upon their traditions. Now, then it brings out again concerning the Halakha and concerning the Halakot. Now, he says concerning the Halakha, it says the Halakha were either simply the laws laid down in Scripture or else derived from or traced to it by some ingenious and artificial method of exegesis, or added to it by way of amplification for safety's sake, or finally, legalized customs. They provided for every possible and impossible case, entered into every detail of private, family, and public life, and with iron logic, unbending rigor, and almost minute analysis pursued and dominated man, turned whither he might, laying on him a yoke which was truly unbearable. In describing the historical growth of the Halakha, we must dismiss in a few sentences the legends of Jewish tradition about patriarchal times. They assure us that there was an academy and a rabbinical tribunal of Shem. Now that was one of the sons of Noah. And they speak of traditions delivered by that patriarch to Jacob, of diligent attendance by the latter on the rabbinic college, of a tractate in some 400 sections on idolatry which was supposedly given by Abraham, and of his observance of the whole traditional law. Now, you go back to Genesis 26:5, which we covered, and you will see that it doesn't define any of the commandments, the laws, or the statutes that Abraham obeyed, and yet the traditionalists go back and claim that it was everything that they had now come up with so many hundreds and hundreds of years after Abraham. Now, here is how they talk about some of these things here. It says of the introduction of these three, daily times of prayer successively by Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and of the three benedictions in the customary grace at meal as propounded by Moses, Joshua, and David in Solomon, and of the Mosaic introduction of the practice of reading lessons from the law on Sabbaths, new moons, and festival days, and even on the Mondays and Thursdays, which then were the Pharisaic fast days, and of that by the same authority of preaching on the three great festivals about these feasts. Further, they ascribe to Moses the arrangement of the priesthood into eight courses, that into 16 to Samuel, and into 24 by David, and also the duration of the time for marriage festivals and for mourning in the event of death. But evidently, these are vague statements with the object of tracing traditionalism and its observance to primeval times, even as legend had it, that Adam was born circumcised, and later writers that he had kept all the ordinances. But other principles apply to the tradition from Moses downward. According to the Jewish view, God had given Moses on Mount Sinai alike the oral and written law. Now, most of what the traditionalism of Judaism is about is the so-called oral law, which then was supposed to have been passed down so that what they have today is authentically what God gave Moses on Mount Sinai with the written law. That God had given Moses on Mount Sinai alike the oral and the written law, that is, the law with all of its interpretations and applications. From Exodus 20, verse 1, it was inferred that God had communicated to Moses the Bible, the Mishnah, and Talmud, and the Haggadah, even to that which the scholars would in later times propound. In answer to the somewhat natural objections as to why the Bible alone had been written, it was said that Moses had proposed to write down all the teachings entrusted him, but the Almighty refused on account of the future subjection of Israel to the Gentiles who would take from them the written law. Then the unwritten traditions would remain to separate Israel from the Gentiles. Popular exegesis found this indicated even in the language of prophecy. Well, there's no such thing in the Bible which shows any of that. Continuing now, he says, but traditionalism went further and placed the oral law actually above the written law. The expression, after the tenor of these words, I have made a covenant with you and with Israel, was explained as meaning that God's covenant was founded on the spoken word in opposition to the written words. If the written was thus placed below the oral law, we can scarcely wonder that the reading of the holy writings was actually prohibited to the people on the Sabbath. Now, the holy writings are those called the Psalms. Okay? For fear that it might divert attention from the learned discourses of the rabbis. The study of them on that day was only allowed for the purpose of learned investigation and discussions. Then it talks about how the law was divided into three sections, as it were. One, those who are found in the Bible. The laws and usage prevailed from time immemorial, and which, according to Jewish view, had been orally delivered to but not written down by Moses. So you've got those extra things. For these, therefore, no proof was to be sought from Scripture. In other words, if they proclaimed it an oral law, if it was a holocaust, then you didn't need any proof. All he needed to say was that it was the oral law, nor were these open to discussion. The second class formed some more part of the oral law, which then was not based on Scripture or the traditional teaching in the stricter sense. To this class belonged all that was supposed to be implied in or that could be deduced from the law of Moses. The latter contained indeed in substance or in germ, everything. But it had not been brought out till circumstances successfully evolved what from the first had been provided for in principle. For this class of ordinances, reference to and proof from the Scripture was required. Now let's continue on here, the next one. Not so for the third class of ordinances, which were the hedge drawn by the rabbis around the law to prevent any breach of the law or customs, to ensure that their exact observance or to meet the particular circumstances and dangers. These ordinances constituted the sayings of the scribes or of the rabbis. This body of traditional ordinances forms the subject of the Mishnah or second, that is, the repeated law. We have here to place on one side the law of Moses as recorded in the Pentateuch as standing by itself. All else, even the teachings of the prophets or the holy writings, that is the Psalms as they're commonly called, as well as the oral traditions, bore the general name, which means to be that which has been received. After explaining some about the Talmud, the Babylonian Talmud and the Mishnah, then Edersheim makes this summary statement. It is sadly characteristic that practically the main body of Jewish dogmatic and moral theology is really only Haggadah, and hence of no absolute authority. Now, what he's really saying is that all of the traditions, which are the interpretations of various rabbis, have absolutely no authority whatsoever. Then he talks a little bit about the halakha, which is then those things which are supposedly based on scripture. The halakha indicated with the most minute and painful punctiliousness every legal ordinance as to the outward observance, and it explained every bearing of the law of Moses. So what he is showing here, that even the laws and commandments of God were taken and just literally torn apart by all of this traditionalism, so that by time we come down to the time of Jesus, you've got very little left concerning the scriptures and the laws of God, and therefore we see and understand why Jesus chose those people who were from Galilee, who were not infected with this hideous Pharisaism and traditionalism, which was just based upon the opinion of peoples, of rabbis, and opinions of so-called legal scholars who just laid these heavy burdens to be borne upon the people as they gave their pronouncements. Okay? Now, let's just finish a little bit here more with Edersheim, and then we'll be pretty well done with the summary of some of the things that he brought out, but also this will help us then in understanding some of the things that Jehoiakim Jeremias wrote. Edersheim then says this of the New Testament compared to the rabbinical traditions, which he calls contrariety. Rabbinism started with a demand of outward obedience and righteousness and pointed to sonship as its goal. The gospel starts out with the free gift of forgiveness through faith and of sonship and pointed to obedience and righteousness as its goal. In truth, rabbinism as such had no system of theology, only what ideas, conjectures, or fantasies the Haggadah yielded concerning God, angels, demons, man, his future destiny and present position, and Israel with its past history and coming glory. Accordingly, by the sight of what is noble and pure was a terrible mass of utter incongruities, of conflicting statements and too awful debasing superstitions, the outcome of ignorance and narrow nationalism, of legendary coloring of biblical narratives and scenes, profane, coarse, and degrading to them, the Almighty Himself and His angels taking part in the conversations of rabbis and the discussions of academies, nay, forming a kind of heavenly Sanhedrin which occasionally requires the aid of an earthly rabbi. The miraculous merges into the ridiculous and even the revolting. Miraculous cures, miraculous supplies, miraculous help, all for the glory of great rabbis who by a look or word can kill and restore life. At their bidding, the eyes of a rival fall out and are again inserted. Nay, such was the veneration due the rabbis that Rabbi Joshua used to kiss the stone on which Rabbi Eliezer had sat and lectured, saying, "This stone is like Mount Sinai, and he who sat upon it like the ark." Modern ingenuity has, indeed, striven to suggest deeper symbolic meaning to such stories. It should own the terrible contrast existing side by side, Hebrewism and Judaism, the Old Testament and traditionalism, and it should recognize its deeper cause in the absence of that element of spiritual and inner life which Christ has brought. Thus, as between the two, the old and the new, it may be fearlessly asserted that, as regards their substance and spirit, there is not a difference, but a total divergence of fundamental principle between rabbinism and the New Testament, so that the comparison between them is not possible. Here, there is absolute contrariety. Now, that's why I have said emphatically and dogmatically that true Christianity, or what we could coin a new phrase, Christian Christianity, never had anything to do with rabbinism, never had anything to do with Judaism, and so therefore when people come along and try and take Christianity back and put it to the old wineskin of traditionalism, it is not going to result in salvation. The painful fact just referred to is only too clearly illustrated by the relation in which the traditionalism places itself to the scriptures of the Old Testament, even though it acknowledges their inspiration and authority. Israel, that is, Judaism, made void the law by its tradition. Under a load of outward ordinances and observances, its spirit had been crushed. The religion, as well as the grand hope of the Old Testament, had become externalized. And so, alike heathenism and Judaism, it was no longer the pure religion of the Old Testament. Each following its own direction had reached its goal. All was prepared and waiting, and then he goes on, and all was prepared and waiting for Christ to come and to bring the gospel of the New Testament. So Edersheim does a pretty good job in what he brings out here, but I tell you, it's really tough reading. And that's why very few people have read it, but if you want to take the time, if you have the time, go ahead and get the book, The Life and Times, This is the Messiah. There are many, many good things in it. There are some things in it which are most difficult. There are other things in it which are really not quite as factual as they ought to be, but it's worthwhile to get and to read and to understand. Well, in closing, I need to mention that this will help you understand the great severity of how Judaism looked upon Jesus and the apostles and attempting to kill them, attempting to destroy everything they do, sending out false apostles, false epistles and letters and all of these sort of things, which we will cover a little later. But now you know why there existed such hostility between the Jewish religious leaders and Jesus Christ and also the apostles, and why they later did everything they could to destroy Christianity, to destroy the apostles, and that's why God had to totally reject them and destroy Jerusalem and cast them out completely. And you know, the big problem is that the same attitudes of the Jews are there to this very day. Well, on the next one, Scripturalism versus Judaism, we'll get into what would it be like to be in the church of the Pharisees.